And I'm fucking livid that we are stuck in the timeline where Alex Jones is right. Kind of works.
Why aren't the Amish afraid of COVID? Because they don't have TVs.
As I said, democracy is a system that reinforces authoritarian ideals.
I hope I don't get canceled. Talk to Steve.
Being a victim of a tragedy doesn't make you an expert in public policy.
But I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
Remember, they lost the Afghan war 10 years ago.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
I said, you don't get to tell us no. We're in the state health department. And I said, hell no.
It wasn't making Christianity better. It was making rock worse.
What the fuck do you have on your face, Olivia?
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
I remember thinking, man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, shitposters, and people of the internet, thank you for tuning in to another episode of O'Donnell for Liberty. As always, I'm your host, Justin. And before we get started, just remember to whatever platform you listen on, whether YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or LRN.fm, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and sharing it with your friends. If you enjoy the content, you can join our production team by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell for Liberty. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell4. Liberty. And make sure to check out sneckswag.com for all your favorite Liberty merch, including some brand new designs for t-shirts, hoodies, stickers, coffee mugs, tote bags, and more. Again, that's sneckswag.com. You can check out the awesome new collection of ungovernable swag today, right in time for the new year. And if you want to keep in touch between shows, make sure you join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans of the show at any time. All these links can be found in the description of the video or podcast you are listening to, as well as on O'Donnell4Liberty.com. So check the description for that link and make sure you give it a visit today. Now, what does the word libertarian mean? It's been used to mean a lot of things over the years. Its roots lie in French anarchists and socialists during the upheaval of early Europe. And over time, it's evolved to mean what we know and think of as American libertarianism, a philosophy of free markets and individual responsibility centered around human action or praxis and voluntary exchange. But the culture war runs deep in all things. And the battle between left and right is taking center stage in the libertarian movement as those who care more about respectability politics and being awakened and woke have taken the opportunity to pervert the message of liberty. But embracing populist messaging that strays from the core of individual responsibility, but they aren't opposed. And tonight's guest is one of those fighting to reclaim the word libertarian from those who've watered it down to the point where it means nothing and has become entirely unrecognizable to what brought us in. Please give a warm welcome to the show all the way from Massachusetts, Andrew Cordio. Andrew, thanks for joining the show tonight. How are you?
Very good, Justin. Thank you, man.
So you're in the heat of the thick of it, the woke Massachusetts Libertarian Party. Fill people in. Like, what's going on? You've been involved as a libertarian for quite a long time compared to a lot of the people who are affiliated with the Mises Caucus who just kind of popped up in the past year or two and decided to get involved. You're running for office back when I still lived in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I first ran for office as a libertarian. I first ran in 2017. That was before the Mises Caucus existed. So, yeah, I've been trying to get the word of liberty out in Massachusetts for a little while now.
So I think first and foremost, the question is, like, what is it that brought you to liberty? What brought you to the libertarian movement, and what was your libertarian moment?
I mean, I've come full circle. I graduated high school in 2008, and I was full, Obama guy. I bought that, hook, line, and sinker, and as the years went on, his story didn't add up, and the Republican, narrative never really made sense to me. And, it became apparent, we're just kind of getting manipulated and lied to. And then, I found Tom Woods, and then I found Dave Smith, and that just kind of led me down the rabbit hole of, Massachusettian thinking.
So you must be an awful racist neo-Nazi. If you came from Tom Woods and Dave Smith, to hear some say it, the only way they can bring people to the libertarian movement is by embracing alt-right and hardcore right-wing supremacists, which I know is not true. The people I've worked with show that to not be true.
Yeah.
But what kind of people have you worked with that they've brought to the movement?
Great guys. Yeah. The Massachusetts Mises Caucus, we've been meeting for about a year now. We started meeting in January this year. So our next meeting will be our 1 year anniversary. And that started with, I think there were 6 of us at the first meeting. And our last meeting, we had over 30, you know, so, and they're just, you're talking just good people, you know. Brody and Jason, who are our state organizers, you know, Brody's, mm-hmm. he goes MIT, you know what I mean? Like, well, I'll just let that speak for itself, you know? Tom Edlam is a great guy who's jumped on board. He's a writer. A lot of libertarians might know him, some of his work. He's written for just about any type of libertarian organization there is. He's awesome, you know? And it's just it's one of the most interesting groups of people that I've been around.
You know, I left Massachusetts early 2017, right about the time when those elections were kicking off where you were running. And before I moved to New Hampshire, ran to New Hampshire, I had a mild disagreement with the Commonwealth over some things that I owned that they didn't like. And so I moved a few minutes north to where they were perfectly legal. Yeah. But I was on the state committee in the Massachusetts LP, and I hate to say I was one of the more active people like myself, Chris Crawford, Dan Fishman, Pete Everett were the only ones who ever did anything for the LP. It was a virtually dead organization. Ooh. But you guys have been reviving it. You guys have been doing things, protests, but the state party hasn't been helping.
The way I look at it, it's culture building, you know. I think that's been the issue with the libertarian movement, you know, especially here in Massachusetts. And we've gotten, you know, I'll say a cold shoulder from the state committee. They're not thrilled with our brand of libertarianism.
Well, what makes your brand of libertarianism something not to be thrilled with in their minds?
Well, we're just, I mean, when you talk about a Massachusetts libertarian, you know, you're talking, yep. you're talking a left-wing guy right now, you know what I mean? Most of the time, they're pretty much leftists. And their issues are what you would expect them to be, you know, coming from that side of the aisle. They're emotional, and you know they're not worried about the economics of the situation, and they're not too worried about pointing the finger at the government. It seems like when they're ready to step on everybody's neck, they've been non-existent on the COVID front. You know what I mean? They've had no messaging here in the state. You know, they're ready to put vaccine passports in Boston, and I haven't seen a tweet.
To say a Massachusetts libertarian is just a typical leftist, it's an old joke. We usually call a Massachusetts Republican is just a New Hampshire Democrat. Ooh. Because of how watered down politics in that state have become. They're just a one-party state. So are you kind of implying that maybe it still is just a one-party state, even with the Libertarian Party growing, at least as in a leadership manner?
Yeah, definitely. From the state committee level, it's very much, you know, a left-leaning organization. They've pretty much been, you know, outright clear that they don't want any, you know, right-leaning libertarians, you know, involved in the party.
What defines a right-leaning libertarian? I mean, I think to me, that's the crux of the issue here, is people trying to define each other's ideologies yeah. based on a right-left paradigm, which sets us up for disagreement, rather than focusing on the fact that we're all libertarian and there are certain fundamental truths that we should agree on, such as voluntary exchange and a consent-based culture, rather than using the force of the state. But like, when they say they don't want anybody who's a right-leaning libertarian coming in, what are they, like, what's a right-leaning libertarian to them?
I mean, as far as I can tell, it's somebody who's more concerned with economics and you know, 2A rights and civil liberties and you know, coming at libertarian from that point of view, opposed to, you know, gender rights and, you know, equality. What's their new thing? I don't even know what their new thing is. Equity, I don't even know.
Equity, yeah, equality.
You know, their talking points are hollow. Which is, you know, a reason why there's only, I think, like 200 registered libertarians in the state right now.
200 registered or 200 dues-paying members?
Well, 200 dues-paying members, yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean, we only have about that in New Hampshire, but we're about a third the size of Massachusetts.
Mm.
And I know we do here in New Hampshire have the largest concentration in the country of libertarians per capita. But being right next door, there should at least be some bleed over. And it's not like Massachusetts is this hyper-liberal bastion. Like, there's a reason, well, Massachusetts keeps electing a supermajority of Democrats to its House and its Senate. They keep electing Republican governors because the independent-minded Massachusetts voter recognizes the need for some kind of a rubber-stamped disagreement at that level. But you look at the culture of, like, even just, like, west of 495, Worcester County in west, western Massachusetts isn't a liberal bastion that you would think of when you think of Boston. It might as well be southern New Hampshire for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, no, I agree, and that's where I come from. I live in Worcester County. I'm about a 20-minute drive from New Hampshire. There's a lot of people in my city who drive to New Hampshire to go buy things to avoid the state sales tax, you know? And, yeah, I mean, that's what's makes it kind of such a shame with where the state committee is right now, because I feel like with the proper messaging and with the proper organization pointed in the right direction, there is that hunger here in Massachusetts for, you know, a different point of view to really, you know, hear that truth. And people are sick of the government, and there you can tell, you know, there is a lot of blue collar people here in this state, you know, and they're getting,
and it's not like Massachusetts Republicans are doing anything to pick up that vote.
No, yeah, not at all. Yeah, unfortunately, no.
They just take it for granted. And unfortunately, when I lived in Massachusetts, I felt that way for a long time. Before I got involved in the Libertarian Party, I was a tried and true Republican voter in Massachusetts. And I considered voting Republican a form of self-defense because there was no other viable option. Where I lived in Massachusetts, there weren't Libertarians on the ballot. There never was. There never would be. Nobody ever cared. The closest we came to was Joe Kennedy running for Congress as a Liberty Party candidate, where he petitioned on as the Liberty Party. And almost got second place because people got confused because his last name was Kennedy. Just to show you how low information a voter in Massachusetts typically is. But I remember in 2012 watching the Republican primary, and I was just so pissed off with Mitt Romney. Mm. After living under Mitt Romney, after experiencing Romney care, after experiencing Massachusetts gun control and healthcare regulation that Mitt Romney put into place and that Mitt Romney exceeded as governor of Massachusetts, that when Gary Johnson and Ron Paul start arguing over whether or not heroin should be legalized, I'm like, these are the two most reasonable people on the stage. Like, and that was my entry. My entry was actually because I thought Gary Johnson was more sane than Ron Paul. I'm like, that crazy old guy is trying to argue to legalize heroin. I'm like, that's a dumb idea. I'll vote for Gary Johnson. Mm. Fast forward 7 years, and I realized the error of my ways, and we should definitely legalize heroin. But like, there's a pipeline there. But the Massachusetts Republican Party isn't doing anything to attract those people. The Massachusetts Republican Party isn't doing anything to pick up that disaffected vote. So why aren't libertarians going after it?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a good answer for it. You know, the ground's fertile. They seem to be, you know, concerned with, you know, capitulating to the social, you know, norms, and they don't want to leave that mainstream narrative. You know, they want to get the thumbs up from, you know, the blue checkmark people.
Well, as a blue checkmark people myself, they're not doing a great job of it. Because usually when I hear people talking about complaining about right-wing libertarians, whenever I ask them to explain what they think right-wing libertarians are, it comes down to people whose entire focus is property rights, which is kind of the basis of all voluntary interaction. Because you can't voluntarily exchange something if you don't own it. You can't have a right to your own labor and the product of your labor if you don't own your body and you own your labor. And so, like, fundamentally, your ownership of yourself and your God-given property rights are the basis of all freedoms. And I think approaching a philosophy in a manner where you discount anybody who has that belief is antithetical to what we know as American libertarianism. And as I said before, like, libertarian has meant a lot of things to a lot of different people over the years. The first usage of the word libertarian was actually anarcho-socialists, who were using it to describe a very, very economically left-wing philosophy of anarcho-communism that they were fighting for in France and in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. the American version is really kind of something new, circa the 1970s when it started to become popular. But we're already losing it.
Yeah.
And like we're already losing it, and we're losing the fight to people who I've taken the term regime libertarian to heart. People like the Cato Institute, Reason Magazine, who are caving to regime talking points and supporting the statist agenda of manipulation and force and the monopoly on force in the name of the greater good. Ian, you touched on it earlier with COVID. The lack of COVID messaging response from the Massachusetts Party or from the National Party or from many state libertarian parties has been a huge driving force and a driving factor in escalating this so-called culture war to the level where we're at now. Because people like yourself, people like me, are very angry that the single greatest expansion of government power in our lifetimes, the single greatest growth of the monstrosity of government in our lifetimes, and the single most expansive destruction of human rights in our lifetime has gone unopposed by the political party whose basis should be individual rights.
Yeah, I fully agree. And it's a shame. It's really a shame, you know, and it needs to be said. So if they're not going to, if the people in charge aren't going to be the ones to, you know, stick the chest out and say the harsh things that need to be said, then somebody needs to do it.
Yeah, and you're with the Mises Caucus now. You weren't always, because they weren't always a thing. And you guys are trying to turn the tide. What are you guys doing to try and turn the tide in Massachusetts?
Two or three weeks ago, there was a the state committee here in Massachusetts. What they did is that they've put forth a code of conduct, which is, it's very vague, very arbitrary. They're pretty much giving themselves the right to just cut membership when they disagree with people. So once we saw that take place, what we did is we got a petition together with all the members of the state. We got our signatures together, and we put forth a petition to hold a special convention where we would nominate a new state committee.
And when is that? How was that received? let's start there.
It was received well. As you can imagine, the state committee wasn't too happy with it. Now, we still don't have a date for the special convention. They put it on the back burner. They're blaming it on Christmas and New Year's and stuff, which is fine. You know, we have there's the way the state bylaws are. They have 30 days to give us a date for our special convention. So hopefully we'll get that date soon. I think it's been about 15 days already.
Now, I did hear a rumor that they had attempted to try and discredit your petition and say people weren't eligible.
Well, yeah, they're sneak. Yeah, they're trying to, work the code of they're trying to work the state bylaws in their own favor. So what they're saying is if you're a monthly dues paying member, you're not actually a voting member. You need to be paid for a whole year, 12 months, which is, you know. That's just them trying to block people from voting, you know, because we've grown the membership more in the last 6 months than the state committee has. You know, I think our peak here in Massachusetts was in like the Bill Weld era when he was a libertarian. Right. Yeah. And we had about 1,200 dues paying members at that point, and it's down to 200, you know, and then they're non-existent.
I can tell you, I worked on the Bill Weld campaign. I worked on the Johnson Weld campaign, and that was one of the most stressful things I've ever done. It's what got me started in the Libertarian Party. And I started voting Libertarian when Gary Johnson ran in 2012. But in 2016, I had like that perfect storm of like fun employment. I just quit a job. I had a lot of time off, and the election was going on. I wanted to get more politically involved. And it was actually Dan Fishman and Chris Crawford who reached out to me and invited me to help with the petition drive in Massachusetts. And I ended up, I think I single-handedly gathered almost a third of the total signatures for that petition drive to get Johnson Weld on the ballot. And then the National Party paid me to go to New Hampshire to do the same thing. And I met some great friends in New Hampshire, ended up wanting to stay here. For other reasons, but when I was in New Hampshire, in Massachusetts, like petitioning in Worcester and Natick and Wellesley and downtown Boston, it was a constant recurring thing that we would get from people. And of course, we were going to events like Pride, big gatherings to try and petition at. People say, oh, I'd feel, they'd be signing the petition and say, I'd feel a lot better about this ticket if it was reversed and it was Weld Johnson. Well, like the liberals in Massachusetts really loved Bill Weld and they wished he was on top of the ticket. And then when I started petitioning just a few miles north in Nashua and Manchester, New Hampshire, people would outright refuse to sign the petition because Bill Weld was on it. And that's when I realized like a lot of the truly liberty-minded people in Massachusetts fled the state because of Bill Weld, because it was Bill Weld's gun control policies that drove a lot of the libertarian and like spirit of rebellion. Boston is the cradle of the revolution. It's the birthplace of American liberty. And I ask myself day in and day out how people can walk the streets of Boston past these monuments, past Faneuil Hall, past the site of the Boston Massacre, past Sam Adams' grave, and not feel like they're oppressed by the state. Given that all these icons and these pieces of history of people who felt the slightest oppression from the state and threw off their chains and killed their masters over it is the basis of their culture and their community. And it's because they all ran away. It's because libertarians for a long time weren't willing to fight. They just ran away to where it was more free. And I think we've seen the stark difference here in COVID approach, where in New Hampshire, our state legislature passed an outright ban on lockdowns. Nobody's, no mask mandates in the state anymore. I haven't worn a mask in 2 years. Like, but I can't go to Boston. I tried to go to a Red Sox game in Boston a few months ago. They wouldn't move the green line until I put a mask on. And that was just accepted.
So yeah. It's crazy how the culture can change, you know, from just a few miles, you know, one or the other.
But if you guys have had any kind of success in recruiting, similar to what New Hampshire's had since the quote-unquote Mises Caucus takeover, then you Mises Caucus must be over half the membership in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it must be pretty close. Yeah, I would imagine. I don't know what the exact numbers are.
But So I think somebody reported to me the last one, you only had a little under a little over 200 members in the state. And here in New Hampshire, over half the membership is we've lost a lot of members since the quote-unquote Mises Caucus takeover. People have quit their membership, don't want to be a part of it because those awful racists have taken over the party. But we've still tripled the size of the party. Even accounting for the losses, we've tripled the size of the party.
That's what will continue to happen. I think that's what will continue to happen because the message is so clear. And especially now, with like you said, with the COVID, with the tyranny and the lockdowns, and people are starting to look around and they are starting to look at those statues of Sam Adams and they are starting to remember the things that Ben Franklin said, the little bit that they do remember from high school, you know, and then things aren't adding up anymore. And you look at the leadership, you know, from Washington, from the state house here, it's just, it's poor. It's poor. It's a poor excuse for leadership, and they're taking way too much from us, and people are getting sick of it.
Now, you actually ran for office this year in the middle of the worst of the quote-unquote pandemic and the worst of the lockdowns and the government overreach. You decided to stand up and do something about it. What did you run for?
I ran for mayor of my city, Fitchburg, Massachusetts.
And why did you decide to run for mayor?
Somebody needed to. I mean, if you know, like, if you know the local politics here in Fitchburg, it's very... There's a lot going on, but it's very small. There's a very small, very Democrat established government going on here in my city, and someone they built a new, you know, $27 million city hall, they maxed out our bond capacity for like the next 20 years or something doing it. And it is the spending's out of control. The roads are terrible in this city. Like, people are just, you know, they're sick of it.
It's just so striking to hear that. And like, people finally getting sick of it. And I grew up in North Attleboro, Massachusetts. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. I think it's one of the last red towns in Massachusetts where they just vote Republican straight ticket across the board. Scott Brown was their state senator. Betty Poirier is their state rep. I think Trump actually won that town And it was like the one little piece of red in all of Massachusetts for Trump, two elections in a row. But I remember when they tried to pitch building a new high school for us, when I was in middle school at the time. I just remember the debate around it and everyone getting all upset. And my mom explaining that it was a waste of goddamn money to build this new high school. And they didn't build it. And they weren't trying to raise taxes. They weren't trying to do anything like that. They didn't have to borrow money. It's just that a new development had gone in about a decade prior, and it was all multi-million dollar homes, and it was all Patriots and Red Sox players who lived in those homes. And because of their property taxes on those homes, the town had more money than it could spend. Like, they actually had a budget surplus, and like, we don't know what to do with all of this. Like, let's build a new police station and a new high school, and we still won't run out of money. And people were like, nope, can't do it. That's a waste of money. Yeah. And they never updated the high school. So maybe more of that needs to happen in Massachusetts, but it sounds like you were trying to do it in Fitchburg. Like, how did you go about campaigning? How did you go about getting your message out to people in Fitchburg? Because it is a nonpartisan race. It's a local election. It's not like social media does all that great in advertising. It's not like getting on the news or trying to get news coverage is going to do all that great, because it is local and you don't want to waste your reach going outside of that. How did you approach things?
Yeah. So me personally, I'm very blessed. So my family owns a breakfast diner in Fitchburg. So I cook and nice. Talk to people all day. We've been there. It'll be 22 years. My family's owned this place next month. And so I'm fortunate in that regard, where I'm just talking to people all day long. You know, we got firefighters, cops, business people, you know, anybody you can think of, you know, comes into the diner. So I'm able to talk to people face to face that way a lot. Mm-hmm. And then with the social media, and I reached out a lot via email, and the door knocking wasn't having the best luck door knocking, because I didn't want to wear a mask. And people were just not very receptive to a stranger knocking on their door yet, you know? So that kind of put a hiccup on things for me. But yeah, I felt it went well. You know, I got 26, 27% of the vote, you know, and he's an established guy, you know, 20-something years. He was a city councilor, state rep, and then he became mayor. Yeah, so, you know, he's been around for a long time. Like you said, there's an establishment here. And people were receptive to the message, man. You know, people want the change. They want the change everywhere. And, you know, it wasn't enough to get it done this time. But a big part of that is because I had no help from the state. You know, the state committee ignored my entire campaign. You know, all my help was volunteer guys from the Mises Caucus and, you know, family and friends.
And it's great that you had what help you did. And it's terrible that you didn't get the help from the organization. But I think something to focus on there is 26, 27%. Like, it seems like a downer number. It was just a two-way race, right?
Yep, it's me and him.
So it seems like a downer number, especially if you're running against an unpopular incumbent. But, like, if you were hampered by your inability to engage in typical retail politics because people didn't want to answer the goddamn door because you weren't wearing a mask, and I don't blame you. Like I said, I haven't worn a mask in 2 years. And I go door to door and I do stuff for work in person. People, New Hampshire is a different culture. You should look into it. But like, that's one of the biggest avenues of getting people out to vote, is actually talking to them in person at their door.
Yeah.
It's tried and true. It's known as one of the most important parts of any local campaign, is knocking the doors, shaking the hands, and meeting your voters. Like, there's something that in political science, in with campaign consultants, what we call a win number. We tell anybody before they launch a campaign, it's like, okay, what's your win condition and what's your win number? Your win number is how many votes you need to win, assuming an above average turnout in election. Okay, in order to get that many votes, how many doors do you have to knock and how many hands do you have to shake? Because it's not just knocking on every door. It's knocking on every door, knowing that a percentage of them are going to go bad and that you're not going to win their vote.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But it's a calculation. You know, in order for you to even be in a race for mayor in a city of 100,000 people, you need to knock on 20,000 doors, whether it's you or your volunteers.
Sure.
Like, you have to know those numbers going into it. And if you're not getting help doing the door knocking, in you have a huge push from government telling people not to answer their door, from the incumbent telling people it's not safe to talk to people coming to their door in a traditional retail politics fashion, it changes the game entirely. And to not have the support and resources of your party behind you when you're doing that, even though it's a nonpartisan election, I would buy it if they said, it's a nonpartisan election, we can't get too involved, because there are rules about that. But I don't think there was a day that went by that I didn't see the state party pushing Ashley Shade on Twitter for her nonpartisan city council race.
Yep.
Now, what issues were you running on when you were door knocking and when you were talking to people?
The big ones were the mask mandates at the time he's got in the city. They were going through the process of they're going to implement mask mandates at the schools, make all the kids wear them, which I fought that at the Board of Health meetings. I was able to hold that off, which was good. And then just fiscal responsibility, you know, that the spending in our city is outrageous. This guy's been our mayor for, it's going to be 7 and 8 years now. But when I was running, he was 6 years in, and he raised our budget almost $30 million in 6 years. You know, we don't have really anything to show for it. You know, as somebody who lives in the city, the population has grown. There's no real justification for that kind of spending increase. And, you know, it's out of hand, and there's no signs of it slowing down here. So, you know, that's where I came from. And, people were receptive to it. The people who are paying attention, they know. But with the COVID stuff and everybody, people, you know, sheltered, we have about 45,000 people in our city, and we had 3,500 votes, 3,600 votes. You know, we didn't even get 10% of the population to turn out, you know, because that was the incumbent's kind of strategy, was to just pretend I'm not even running, you know, kind of try to black hole me. And then when I got the state committee, he was supposed to be in my corner, black hole me too. You know, I'm just kind of fighting in the dark. But you know, I was proud of everything. I don't want to sound, you know, like I'm complaining or anything. It went really well. I was proud of what I put together. I had a lot of great conversations with people, and
complaining is my job. Complaining is what I'm here to do. So, like, what I'm taking away from this is you got 26, 27%. You got a quarter of the vote. You convince people to turn out to vote on actual libertarian platform, on actual libertarian issues, on curtailing government and taking overreach a step back in helping people regain some semblance of sovereignty over their lives and their money and their government. Meanwhile, what the state party was so focused on celebrating and pushing was Ashley Shade run for city council, where she didn't run on libertarian issues. She didn't run on the ideas of praxis and human action and fiscal responsibility. One of her actual platform pieces that I saw was about increasing the police budget so they could comply with Title IX for women's locker rooms. Like, how is that a libertarian issue to run on?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not, you know, but these are the people that have been in charge for a while up there now. You know, they got their own little circle going, and
like if it's a major cultural issue and like everyone in your district cares about the women police not having a big enough locker room, sure, say something about it. But the libertarian answer is not spend more money.
Right. No, exactly. No, it's embarrassing, really. I mean, if you ask me, but that's.
It's an utter embarrassment.
At anybody specifically, you know what I mean? But it's just, yeah, that type of messaging isn't helping us. It's not going to get us anywhere.
And to me, like, the biggest part of the embarrassment isn't so much that she said it, isn't even so much that they promoted her as a libertarian candidate. They promoted her as the chair of the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, right.
So when she spoke for all libertarians.
Correct.
And she didn't speak a libertarian truth.
And no.
I think that's the heart of the issue here, is the corruption of the meaning of libertarianism and woke culture, and people who care more about getting elected and saying what they need to say to get elected than actually standing on their principles. And people in power, the sort of like clique of the mean girls and the popular kids who are doing whatever they need to retain their own stature. In this by keeping the liberty movement small and keeping it self-centered and self-focused around them.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Yeah. I mean, I don't know any of these people personally, but the way that they've been treating us for the last few months is there's not really much of an excuse for it. Like,
well, you got the special convention coming up. You're doing things to replace them and to God, I hate saying replace them because it feeds into their own little Charlottesville white nationalist. Like, you will not replace this narrative, yeah. But you know, whatever, replace them because they need to be replaced. What are you doing? What are you running for?
So one of the things you need to fix is the way people get elected here in Massachusetts. So what happens here is the executive committee in Massachusetts is made up of 9 people. So you just run for the executive committee. The top 9 people who get the most votes become the committee, and then they amongst themselves decide who gets what position. We'd like to change that, where, you know, somebody would run for chair, somebody would run for secretary, somebody would run for treasurer, and down the line.
Actually uncommon. That might be uncommon within libertarian state parties, but it's very, very common within like for-profit and nonprofit boards and how organizations structure themselves. I'm on a couple boards myself for a couple nonprofits that I help run and another political action committee outside of the Libertarian Party that I run. And we're all structured that way. The boards are elected by the stakeholders. In our case, we don't have members. And we decide amongst ourselves who's best fit amongst us to be chair based on our working relationships, who's our best fit for secretary. But these are all inherently non-political positions. Where we're focused on the business and growing the business and shepherding the business to success rather than campaigning. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that it's necessarily something that can't work. I think with the right people on a board, it could still work where the board chooses its own chair.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what we would do this time. What I see the issue is what's happened is people will get elected to the state committee, you know, multiple years, but they'll change responsibilities. You know, they'll go from political director to communications director or something like that. And it hinders continuity, you know, where there could be more of it.
It hinders continuity, but at the same time, it also helps develop bigger skill sets.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
So like if somebody's a really good political director, but I have somebody else who might be almost as good of a political director, maybe I want to put the really good guy in charge of comms. That way he spends the 2 years learning comms, getting used to comms. Then when it comes time that I need a campaign manager who understands political and comms, I have somebody.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, no, yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah. So, but the way it's constituted now, if I do get elected to the state committee, I would be the chair, if at the special convention, if all of our guys get elected the way we're thinking it's going to happen, I would be the chair of the Mass Party.
And what is your, again, you guys have a regularly scheduled convention, what, 2 months after the special convention?
Yeah, it's in April. Yeah.
In April. So you have 2 months. You have a 2-month window to enact positive change that shows the membership at large that your ideas were right and that you were right to call a special election to get things done immediately. In that 2 months, what can be done? What are you planning on doing?
Well, within that first 2 months, I mean, we can at least start to message against the state here a little bit. We can at least speak out against the tyranny. You know, it's not like we're going to change the world in 2 months, but we can at least change the messaging and at least try to grab some people's ears and eyes. You know, it's 2 months is it's not a ton of time, but if you put in the work, man, we can get some stuff done. And the organizers that I've been working with here in the state, these guys, they're dedicated and they put a lot of, they put their hours in and they're smart guys and they've gotten a lot done already. And if given the proper apparatus, I think the sky's the limit here in the state.
So I'm looking at things from an outside perspective as someone, I'm not Mises Caucus. I'm very friendly with the Mises Caucus. I've been very friendly with Brody and Masha and a lot of people involved in the Mises Caucus in Massachusetts as well as New Hampshire. But some of the old guard in Massachusetts, not Ashley, not Tara, but like some of the old guard, like Dan Fishman and Chris Crawford, Peter Everett, and George Phillies, they're the people that brought me into the party. And they're people I have an immense amount of respect for. And they're people who, while they might not have been up to snuff in the past year doing the things that needed to be done or the past 2 years, for the longest period of the state party's history, they were the only ones doing anything. And I think a lot of that's been kind of lost to the knowledge of so many new people coming in that don't have that acknowledgement of the history. For there was a decade-long period where the only budget the state party had was what Chris Crawford and Peter Everett wrote out of their own bank account. There was a long period of time where the only budget the state party had was what George Phillies wrote out of his own bank account, where they ran the party. And that was still running candidates. That was running ad campaigns, running statewide petition drives that Chris would finance out of her own pocket. Like, these are people that have sacrificed a lot for the Libertarian Party. These are people who've dedicated their lives to the Libertarian Party in Massachusetts over the past few decades. And I think losing them in the fold is something that the Mises caucus would suffer for long term. That, like, if you guys were to take over and just lose them altogether, it's something long term you would suffer for. Because time's going to come where you're going to need to run a state petition, statewide petition drive, and the only one in Massachusetts that's ever done it before and knows how to do it since I've left is Chris Crawford. Mm-hmm. And she's the best at doing it. Mm-hmm. So what I'm thinking is, like, you're going into the special convention and looking at ousting these people, looking at putting them on the back burner, telling them to take their break, and then 2 months later, you're going into a regular convention where you have to not campaign to your base to keep your seats, not campaign to the Mises caucus to prevent the Prags from taking back over. I think you need to take full advantage of those 2 months, define some goals, target direct, actionable goals to prove to the old guard, to prove to the people who are hesitant about the Mises caucus takeover but have put so much work into the party that it's worth joining forces with you instead of opposing you. And I think you have an opportunity to do that. I don't know what those goals need to be. I don't know what convinces them, but I think you, if you do sweep this special convention and you do get a whole new state committee in there, you have an opportunity to rebuild a bridge that's been burned down.
Mm. Yeah, and that would definitely be one of the goals. I mean, the way I'm looking at this is I don't like you even the term takeover. You know, it's not my favorite term, because and like you said, these people, there's a few people who have dedicated a lot of their hours and a lot of their life to the party, and I don't want to diminish any of that. You know, I mean, I don't want to, you know, disregard what they've done and you know, make it seem like the work that they put in, you know, isn't appreciated. But there is a growing liberty movement that they don't quite seem to be attached to or have, you know, their finger on the pulse correctly. They have, you know, it seems like the wrong ideas about what it is, and it's only getting bigger, and they're not going to stop it. And it's good for the party. And it, as this momentum grows, I hope that they see that, you know, we are aligned morally in, you know, I'm sure a lot more than we aren't. And I would hope that, you know, if this takeover or, you know, this replacement does happen, that, you know, I don't like to see the personal snipes on Facebook and you know, the long threads and you know, the arguing the back and forth over, you know what I mean, who's more important or who's yep. at fault for what. You know, we can rise above that. We can elevate the conversation a little bit, and we can, you know, take control of our messaging towards liberty and pointing the finger out at where the government is, you know, oppressing us. You know, there's a lot to point out here in Massachusetts where we're being oppressed. Like, and the unfortunately, you know, in my eyes, where the state party is concerned and when, you know, where they focus their messaging is not on these points of oppression, you know, that are affecting all of us. Right. And so that's just all I feel. And you know, the group of guys here at the Mises Caucus, and then when we get together, and we just want the pointed messaging to take place where it needs to, and there's a lack of it. And then when you try to ask, you know, where is it, you know, there's a, you know, a finger pointing contest at the state committee. You know, it's not my fault, it's this person's fault, it's this person's fault, it's not me, it's this. And you know, we deserve better leadership than that. And it's nothing personal, you know, and like I said, I don't want to diminish anything that people have done in the past, but we gotta update.
And power to you, and I respect that approach moving forward. It's just the biggest mistake we made here in New Hampshire was burning the bridge even further when it happened. And I think you guys do have a unique opportunity to, like, the bridge is on fire. It's burning down. But you have the opportunity now with two conventions so close together to put out the fire instead of making it worse. Whereas what happened in New Hampshire, it It spiraled. It became unavoidable. It burned down two other bridges, and things started getting even worse. So,
no, I do agree, man. I want the party to be amicable. You know what I mean? Chris Crawford, like you said, she's a hard worker. You know, there's no reason for someone like that to feel like they're ostracized. You know, and hopefully, you know, she wouldn't feel that way, or anybody else would feel that way on the current state committee. You know, we're not trying to do this to, you know, kick them out of the party and ostracize them. We feel like the leadership needs to be taken in a different direction, and that, you know, we have the support of the membership to do that.
So who else is on your slate?
Well, I don't like the term slate, you know, but I mean,
I hate it too, but that's how Massachusetts has been doing it for sure. So long.
Sure.
Yes or no on this slate of people.
Yeah. So, like, I mentioned Thomas Edlam, who's, you know, he's a writer. He's a great guy. He'd be our communications guy. Then there's the technical director would be Brody, where he said he's an MIT kid. So, you know, there you go. Jason Brand, who's been – he's been taking all our minutes for the last year at the Mises meetings. He's going to be on board. Scott David Gray, who's a parliamentarian background. We're going to be on board for secretary to, you know, help us out there. You know, everybody's very qualified. It's not a group of nobodies, you know what I mean, trying to right. drive a car that they don't know how to drive. You know, there's some smart people here.
I love the use of Dr. Everett's joke right there. Car you don't know how to drive, which, to be fair, is originally a Nick Sarwark comment when he accused us of taking a car we didn't know how to drive in New Hampshire, even though we're the ones who've been driving it for 6 years before he showed up. But no, I think it's exciting. I think you guys have a unique opportunity that wasn't present here in New Hampshire and isn't going to be present in Delaware, the way things happen there, with the way things are shaking up. But I do think it's also important to remember how we got here, like the circumstances that led to the special convention being called. It was the membership gave the state committee an ultimatum if they did something, and they did it anyways.
Yeah.
So the membership told the state committee they didn't want purges and gatekeeping, and the state committee started kicking people out of the party. Some bridges might need to be burned. For the health of the movement as a whole, some bridges might need to be burned.
Yeah, and it is what it is. And it's a similar situation here, because when they brought up this code of conduct policy, you know, there was some members that showed up at the state meeting that month, and they were like, if you do this, we're gonna hold a special convention. Like, we were, you know, it was up front, you know. It's not like, you know, any of this happened in the shadows. Like, people aren't gonna be for this code of conduct policy in a libertarian party. Like, you're gonna neuter people's voices in the party of liberty? How does that make any sense to anybody? So, you know, once they did that, then that's where the special convention came around. It wasn't something that was, you know, been planned for a long time. It was actually thrown together very hastily, and it shows, you know, the organization that's been put together in just this year that we were able to get all these signatures all together. You know, I drove around Worcester County collecting signatures for 3 days, you know, and there was three or four other guys doing the same thing.
How many signatures did you guys get total?
I think 50.
50 signatures is more than the amount of people we could get actively involved in helping petition for the Johnson Weld campaign in 2016. The biggest campaign in Libertarian Party history couldn't get 50 people in Massachusetts to do something. But you guys got 50 people who are upset that libertarians weren't doing enough that they're willing to step up and do it.
Yeah.
That's something to be proud of.
Yeah, and exactly. And we are proud. And this is the type of momentum we want to, you know, keep building on, you know? So it's important to keep building on it.
So 2 month plan, fix stuff, get stuff going in the right direction, and sell yourself back to membership in 2 months. What kind of immediate action, what kind of immediate shift in messaging do you think could be put out to, like, really show the shifting course?
Well, I mean, in Massachusetts, I guess the options are kind of endless. I mean, you can talk about you can talk about COVID. We can't put sports bets here in the state. Like, you know, there's all the gun restrictions you can talk about in the state. There's all kinds of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I'm banned from DraftKings because I forgot to turn my VPN on when I was at Fenway Park.
Yeah, see, yeah.
Like, nonsense.
Yeah, it's saving the world there.
Yeah, right. And gambling is perfectly legal in New Hampshire, and I like betting on games. It's a fun thing to do with money I can spare. And I forgot to just flick the VPN button on my phone when I was at Fenway one day for a game. I'm like, oh, I'm going to play some bets. And instant banned. Mm. And they won't let me log back on. They got to fix that.
Saving you from yourself.
No, saving me from myself. I was trying to bet on the Red Sox to lose. Sir, that is a good money bet. Yeah. So I drove down from New Hampshire. There was no way the Red Sox were going to win.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I got bad luck when I go to the stadium, too. I never see them win.
God, I don't think I've ever seen the Red Sox win in Fenway in my entire life. And I've gone to hundreds of games. it's something that blows my mind. I saw them lose 22-3 to the Angels once. Where they had to put the left fielder on the mound. I've seen them lose both games in a doubleheader to Tampa with an unassisted triple play in the bottom of the seventh, the second game.
Ready for the worst story ever, dude? I was in high school with my high school girlfriend and her parents. We were at John Lester's no-hitter when he got done cancer or whatever, and he threw that no-hitter at Fenway. We were there. We were sitting like six rows off the third base, and we left in the eighth inning because her dad was tired. Guy wanted to beat traffic. I'm like, you know, it's a no-hitter going on right now. He's like, ah, we'll get you on the radio.
It's crazy. Boston sports is something you learn to hate as you live with it for your life. But no, I'm excited for you guys. I think you got a lot to look forward to. I think you do have a tough road ahead.
There's definitely work to be put in. None of this is going to be easy.
I do not think it's going to be an easy road. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys do it. I'm looking forward to help. You guys still have – did you guys keep or lose ballot access with Joe Jorgensen?
I believe we still have it.
So I don't remember what her vote total was in Massachusetts. But, like, if you guys – you're going to have petitioning to do for candidates next year either way, because you don't get automatic ballot access for the statewide races. So 10,000 signatures to collect. It's not going to be easy to do, especially if you're going to end up losing people with the bridge burning. In not a real long time to plan it. Have you guys started looking at slates of candidates to run for state offices next year, the partisan races?
I can't say that we have, really. You know, I mean, there's we have and we haven't, you know, there's a list of names. You haven't reached out or anybody like that. We haven't, one step at a time.
I know historically libertarians in Massachusetts do exceptional compared to other states in the auditor's race. New Hampshire, Massachusetts is one of the only states with an elected auditor. Mm-hmm. And that's like kind of universally accepted that people think it's a good idea to have somebody who's not a part of the controlling party as the auditor of the government. To make sure their money's being spent legally, not even efficiently. The auditor doesn't care if they're wasting money or throwing money away at bullshit projects. It's just not embezzling it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
like the fact that that is a statewide office, and it's something that I think almost any libertarian's inherently qualified for.
Yeah. No. Excuse me. And yeah, I've had a conversation with actually two guys who would be willing to run for auditor already.
So I would love to see you guys be able to run somebody for attorney general, but I know that's a long shot. You have to find somebody who's not only qualified, but willing to take the pay cut because not many lawyers are making less than what the attorney general of Massachusetts makes.
Yeah, right.
But no, it's definitely something to look forward to. It's definitely something that's going to be really interesting. To see if you guys can do different and better than we did in New Hampshire and what's going on in Delaware and other state parties. We haven't even touched on the national party corruption and what's going on there. But you guys, if you win the next two conventions over the next 4 months in Massachusetts, you're going to have a huge influence on the delegates and who gets to go to Reno and who to support in Reno. And what are your thoughts? We got a few minutes left. What are your thoughts on the LNC races in the Libertarian National Party and how they've dropped the ball in the past year?
Yeah, it's kind of a similar situation, you know. I think Angela McArdle's, she's great. Her debate the last week or whatever, a couple weeks ago, she's just awesome. You know, I would love to be able to support her in Reno.
So, well, I'm not sure I'm going to Reno this year because for the first time in my LP career, I'm not worried about who's representing my state because we have a great slate of candidates running for delegate. We only have 13 seats here in New Hampshire, but we have like 30 people trying to get them, and they're all great people. And then we have like 6 or 7 awful people trying to get them too, but I'm not worried about that.
Yeah, so I think we have 20 in Massachusetts, and we have a hard time filling them.
So this is my next question here. Massachusetts has 20 delegate spots. Historically, they've had 22. They lost so many members over the past 2 years that Massachusetts actually lost delegate seats for the first time in a long time. Massachusetts hasn't filled their delegation in a long, long time. And like, do you guys plan to send a full 20 people to Reno?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know I would be definitely going.
So, because I remember the last in-person convention we had down in New Orleans, New Hampshire, we were sitting in the back row, just a few rows in front of us was the Massachusetts delegation. It was just empty seats. Bill Weld, empty seats. Chris Crawford. There was like 10 people there. And some of them are great people, but it's always been disheartening to me to see Massachusetts unable to fill its delegation to the national convention. And I think if you guys could get 50 people who are motivated to join your petition to fix the state party, you need to get at least 30 people who are motivated to go to Reno and fix the national party. And yeah, be the first full delegation.
Yeah, with the group of people we have, I wouldn't see that being too much of a problem.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Again, I'm looking forward to seeing how things shake out for you guys and having you guys back on after the dust settles and seeing where your 60-day, two-month plan gets you leading going into the April convention. But tell me where they can follow you, learn more about what you're doing.
TakeHumanAction.com, that's the easiest place to go. If you are from Massachusetts and you're listening, if you do want to join the state organization, that's llama.org. I think it's .org. LAMA.
LPMass.org.
LPMass.org. You join up right there. Get involved because that's what we're all trying to do, you know? Me personally, I'm not big on the social media. I have a Facebook. You can find Andrew Cordio. Just type it on Facebook. You can find me.
Hey, if you're going to be the chair of the state party, you're going to need to get on Twitter.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I've avoided Twitter this entire time. I've never made a Twitter my whole life.
And Twitter's great. I love it. Yeah. All right. Well, it's been real. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And until next time, be free. Thanks again for tuning in and joining us tonight. Make sure you hit that like button and leave a comment below to let us know your thoughts. If you haven't subscribed, go ahead and hit that big red subscribe button on YouTube and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live. If you enjoyed this content, you can join our production team on Patreon by following the link in the description. And don't forget to follow on social media and join our community Discord channel by following the links in the description as well. The best part of all of this is the community that we're building and growing. So go ahead and join us. And thanks once again to our awesome sponsors and patrons for making all of this possible. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts. So until next time, everybody, be free.